I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Andy Dunn, co-founder of Bonobos, an e-commerce company that sells men's clothing. Bonobos started off with the goal of selling better-fitting pants for men in 2007 and expanded to include all types of men's apparel. Bonobos also has guide shops, which are actual stores where customers may try on clothing before they are ordered and delivered to their home. In 2014, Bonobos launched a women's brand called Air and a line of golf clothing called Made. Andy started Bonobos with his Stanford Business School classmate Brian Spaley in 2007. Prior to business school, Andy worked as a consultant for Bain & Company, working on consumer apparel catalog companies like Lands' End. Andy attended college at Northwestern and grew up in Chicago. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
What's the problem with men's pants?
It's actually a pretty simple issue, which is it's an issue of fit. So the American cut trends toward boxy, and we observed this issue that we sort of jokingly started referring to as KDB, which is an acronym for khaki diaper butt. And you kind of see your average guy kind of walking down the street with these ill-fitting khakis, and that's sort of the typical American cut. That's at one end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, you have the European cut, which can look very flattering, but it's probably best observed when a guy is standing up because once he sits down, it's really, really tight. Mm-hmm. And if you've worn these great fitting, really slim fitting, you know, typical European cut pants, they can be really uncomfortable when you're seated.
So were you a khaki diaper butt guy or were you a tight pant guy growing up?
Well, I was a default to denim guy. And I think one of the interesting things that happened in the 90s is we had this massive proliferation of men's jeans that cost over $100. And I remember growing up, you know, that would have been a crazy idea. And I remember going with my dad probably to the Oak Brook Mall near where I grew up in Westchester, Illinois, and trying to convince him to buy my first pair of 7 jeans. And, you know, it's over $100. And my dad's like, what are you talking about? Mm. And so we had this amazing explosion in denim in the 90s, so this premium denim category that produced a lot of great brands. That improvement in fit we haven't actually seen happen on the other side of the aisle, khaki pants, wool pants. So those were the areas that we focused on when we launched Bonobos.
You also had the birth of the metrosexual in a way, where maybe men always cared about what they wear, but it was just heightened.
That's right. There's been a broad-based trend toward men caring more about the fit of their clothes. Traditionally, it's been a feminine sensibility, or it's been a gay sensibility. And so in some regards, that is now changing for all men, where it's no longer okay to not care about how your clothes fit.
Brian Spaley was your classmate at Stanford Business School, and he's the one who came up with this this design of a curved waist so that the back of the pants wouldn't be too saggy. What does the curved waist do?
So it's a curved waistband. And the best way to think about it is that when you buy a belt, like let's say you buy a leather belt, it comes straight. And then as you wear it, it starts to develop a little bit of a sickle shape. I don't know if you've ever noticed, and if you hang your belts up in your closet as I do, you can start to see this curvature. And what that does is it basically enables the pant to come up and around the seat. Said differently, it kind of makes room for your butt. And then the second piece of it is that it enables the ratio between your waist and your thigh to be more flattering. So the typical men's pant, if it's straight, if it fits you in the waist, it's going to have too much fabric in the thigh. Mm-hmm. And if it's tailored fitted through the thigh, it's going to be too tight at the waist. And so a curved waistband has this slight curvature at the top that makes a dramatic difference as you go down the leg of the pant. And the degree to which your pants don't have superfluous fabric in the thigh is actually a big part of how you feel that fit. Mm. That also not only feels good, but looks good.
So he was experimenting with these curved waistbands from his dorm room at Stanford Business School. Was he manufacturing them locally, or where was he experimenting with these?
Yeah, so what happened was he was taking pants that had a straight waistband, taking them to a tailor to get them altered and observing that they were making this adjustment in the waistband. And at some point, he said, why would I have the tailor do that? I'll just figure that out myself. And so he had a girlfriend who bought him a sewing machine. He started actually making the alteration himself. Mm. And then he took a number of these pants that he had altered to a pattern maker in San Francisco and had her make a pattern for the pan with that contoured base waistband to begin with, rather than as a post-purchase alteration. And then he found a little manufacturer in San Francisco, not far from where the Giants play baseball on Townsend Street, one of the last cut-and-sew shops, I imagine, in all of the Bay Area, and started making pants.
How did you both know that you were onto something with these pants? I don't know how serious you were at first about making a go at this, but how did you know that you were onto something?
You know, it's funny. One of our Stanford professors, Andy Ratcliff, who's one of the early founders of Benchmark Capital and now the chairman of Wealthfront, he likes to joke that some of the great businesses that he knows started as hobbies. And I sort of ignored it, and then I watched it happen right under my nose. And so as Brian started making pants in San Francisco, our classmates started buying them, and he would fill these Trader Joe's grocery bags with pants and would walk around the Stanford GSB with Trader Joe's bags of pants and would be selling pants to our classmates.
For how much was he?
So they were about $100 a pair. Mm-hmm. And so at some point, there was a Saturday where he invited a whole truckload of guys to come through our house, which was in Atherton. I like to say we were the poorest people in Atherton, California. I think it's the wealthiest zip code in the country. And here we were, you know, $100,000 plus in Stanford debt living in this house. Well, nevertheless, people are coming through and buying pants, you know, for cash in droves. And I think there was a Saturday where we sold $16,000 worth of pants. And so you've got $16,000 in your room in cash and checks. And I think, you know, you might be able to get $1,000 or $2,000 from your friends just with them being nice. But when you've got that amount of money and you're not selling narcotics, mm-hmm. you know, it probably means that you're onto something.
Now, you had worked for Bain Consulting before business school, and coincidentally, you had some experience with consumer apparel. One of your clients or accounts was Lands' End.
Yeah.
That was kind of just accidental.
Well, this is amazing serendipity. So I had no idea at the time that my time with Lands' End would be incredible training for building Bonobos. Sears' acquisition of Lands' End, it actually exposed a number of great attributes of a direct-to-consumer apparel retailer that are compromised when you move through a traditional brick-and-mortar experience. But it was incredible training for thinking about how a great internet-driven retailer could be built. And if you could use a catalog to build a great apparel brand, couldn't you use the internet to do so? No one had done that at the time, and we were one of the first that tried.
And you are somewhat of a blended model now, being e-commerce at your core, but, you know, partnering with Nordstrom's, your product is in over 100 stores, and also now having these guide shops. It's interesting to kind of find this happy medium over time, I think.
I agree.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Andy Dunn, co-founder of the men's online apparel company Bonobos. Bonobos are also a group of promiscuous apes who live in the rainforest in the Congo in Africa. Andy started Bonobos with his Stanford Business School classmate Brian Spaley in 2007 with the goal of selling simply men's pants that fit. You and Brian, incidentally was only with Bonobos for 2 years, and then he started his own men's apparel company called Trunk Club. You and he set out to raise venture capital at first. Why was that so difficult in the early days, do you think?
I think in a lot of ways, it was a tremendously contrarian idea in 2007 that you would take what was thought of as an internet-driven business model and apply it to being vertically integrated into an apparel label.
Well, you had Gilt Group and you had other e-commerce companies doing it. So why was it anomalous?
You did. And Gilt Group comes from a long line of e-commerce companies, and by long, I mean the last 20 years, that have been successful at selling other brands online. Mm-hmm. So when you're selling other brands, you're catching an existing consumer demand. This was the business model originally behind Amazon. It was what Zappos proved could be brought into the softline space, but largely selling other brands.
Zappos being the shoe company.
The mm-hmm. shoe company.
Yeah.
Diapers.com here in New York, and then these flash sale companies like Gilt. But all of those e-commerce companies are selling other brands. What Bonobos really is the pioneer in doing is proving that you can use e-commerce to develop your own brand. And that turned out to be a bit of an antithetical idea in 2007. In the U.S., bonobos was the first, which made it very hard to attract funding.
You had a lot of friends and family and professors and people part of the Stanford community on board, one of which was Joel Peterson, who's the chairman of JetBlue.
Yeah.
I just mentioned him, but who were some others?
Well, that was it. You know, we walked in and we saw Joel. I saw him like at 5 a.m. Joel gets up unbelievably early. I mean, he's an amazing, amazing guy. He's got something like 7 kids and 21 grandkids. He's been on 36 boards in his career, built 4 or 5 companies, and he still finds time to teach. So I asked him for a meeting in July of 2007, and he said, how about, 6:30 a.m.? And that was probably the earliest I'd gotten up in 2 years at Stanford Business School. And I went and I met him, and I pitched him on this idea of selling these great fitting pants over the internet. And he was largely quiet for a meeting, asked some really good questions, but then he shocked me at the end. He said, well, this reminds me of my first meeting with David Neeleman from JetBlue, which is we're going to take a really innovative approach to a stagnant category and develop a much higher customer affinity brand than our competition. And then he started negotiating with me for how much he was going to invest and how much ownership he was going to have. And I think that was a Friday. The following Monday, I went in to meet this incredible technology venture capitalist, Andy Ratcliff, who was an equally storied lecturer, professor at Stanford. And Andy remarkably offered at the end of our conversation to invest. Well, then what happened was all these customers of ours who were our classmates heard that Joel and Andy, these luminary professors, were investing in the business, and they all then wanted to invest. We ended up raising the rest of the round mostly from customers, throw in a few mentors of ours. Both Brian and I had worked at Bain before Stanford. And then my brother-in-law and sister invested, and my parents asked to invest. I rather famously in our family told them I didn't want to waste their money, and now they're really upset with me that they didn't get to be a part of that seed round.
So it ended up being about 100 angel investors over time?
So it started at that time, maybe it was 25 or 30, mm-hmm. Cobbling together $750,000. We took even a few $5,000 checks from some friends. That was all they had. But then what really made bonobos challenging to finance was that the subsequent rounds all came from angel investors. Mm-hmm. And so that's where the number ended up, probably when all was said and done, in about 100 different angel investors across 4 rounds of capital over the course of 3 years of work. But the institutional folks, your venture capital firms and your strategic investors, they hadn't really bought into this idea yet until 2010, when the world started to change a little bit. What you alluded to with Gill Group, in 2010, some e-commerce companies started to get funded.
Right.
And the water started to change. And this window opened up that really, I think, was open for 2 or 3 years. Mm-hmm. A lot of problematic companies got funded, Fab and Beachmint and Shoe Dazzle and companies like that. But it also enabled, I think, companies, hopefully, including bonobos, that will be successful, like Birchbox and Rent the Runway and Warby Parker and, a lot of these branded e-commerce players to also get access to venture capital.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Andy Dunn, co-founder of bonobos. We'll hear more from Andy coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Andy Dunn, co-founder of Bonobos, an e-commerce company that sells men's clothing. Bonobos started off with the goal of selling better-fitting pants for men in 2007 and expanded to include all types of men's apparel. Andy started Bonobos with his Stanford Business School classmate Brian Spaley in 2007. Logistically, you raised your first round of capital, $750,000, from the Stanford Business School community, and you moved to New York. Mm-hmm. Tell me about the early days.
It was a wild time in retrospect. I mean, I can remember coming down, I think it's 2nd Avenue, with a trunk full of pants in my cab, getting to our apartment. We'd rented an apartment at 17th and Irving, and I came up to the 3rd floor, and within about 2 weeks was over to the Home Depot with another Stanford classmate and his uncle, and we were buying shelves. And I remember we had a negotiation at the door to be able to borrow the cart, and literally we're going down Broadway with the cart, full of shelves, and got the borrowed free labor from the uncle to put the shelves up, and literally put up 400 or 500 pairs of pants, which was our inventory, on the walls of my bedroom.
It's striking that what does go on in New York. I mean, you had a bedroom filled of shelves of pants, hundreds of pairs of pants. And, you know, on the Upper West Side, a woman who started a dog food company had a huge refrigerator in her bedroom of dog food, right? Like, who knows what goes on in the lives of New Yorkers?
Who knows what goes on? I mean, nothing more exciting than the tiger that was up in Harlem. I'm still riveted by that story. But we hired a few employees. You know, our first employee was a novelist, actually, which is sort of a funny first hire. But he was looking for some part-time work. And it was really remarkable. It kind of took off between word of mouth, a little bit of PR that came in. There was a site at that time called Urban Daddy that did a story called Monkey Business or Monkey Pants or something like that, which isn't technically accurate. Actually, bonobos are apes, not monkeys, and they would take great offense at the distinction. But we had about $10,000 in sales that first October. By May, I think we were at over $100,000 a month. And then people started showing up to try on pants at my apartment. And that was when we got in some trouble with our landlord.
Now, did Brian move to New York with you?
So Brian spent that summer and fall working for what had been my previous employer before Stanford, after Bain, was a private equity fund in Chicago. And we had this funny day where I was trying to recruit him back. And so I called him and I said, we really need you. Like, this is going bananas. And I was running up to the garment district to pick up pants and working on the website. And it was really more than I felt like I could handle. And, you know, we needed our creative visionary to come back. And so we had this day where he finally just got the courage to go resign, even though he'd only been on the job maybe 6 months. And I got a phone call, and it was back in the days of ground lines and caller ID. And the caller ID said Windpoint Partners, which is the private equity fund. And I picked it up, and I said, how did it go? And it was my former boss, not Brian, saying, what's going on? Brian just resigned. You know, is this pants thing really working? Like, is this happening? Is he just moving back to New York because he wants to meet girls and work in the fashion industry? And I said, no, it's really going well. Like, and so he came on back, and it was critical for that first 2 years to really build it together.
Speaking of meeting girls, there's a story when you were on a date in the East Village, and this is during the days, even though sales are going so great, that you're very cash constrained.
Yeah.
What's that story?
Well, I think I had sort of the typical New York experience of you're a little bit of a fraud potentially, where you've got a nice apartment and you've got a cool job, but you have no money. Mm-hmm. And that was me. And so I had, you know, maybe $2,000 or $3,000 in the bank. And there was this moment where, you know, well, credit cards can solve everything, right? And I went to a restaurant, and to my horror, it was a cash-only restaurant, and we were mid-meal. And I knew I didn't have enough in my, you know, account at that time. And so I had to find a way to charge my credit card for cash without being gone too long.
Wait, so did you go to an ATM machine?
Yeah, I found an ATM that enabled me to, like, actually do a transaction charging the credit card to get cash. It was sort of a special... Anything can happen in the East Village, apparently.
And so you were cash constrained, but you still had confidence in the business, given the responsiveness of people.
Well, you know, it's funny. My mom is an Indian immigrant, and there's a lot said about the immigrant experience with entrepreneurship. And so for me, it was more, I just couldn't fail. There never was a sense that this brand isn't working.
You and Brian both have an understanding for business and for, you know, fashion, but you're not real tech people. And this is a very tech-heavy concept, ironically. I mean, e-commerce, so much of it, the success of the company is how good is the website.
Yeah.
There are a lot of hiccups regarding the website. Can you talk about some of those?
Totally. You know, it's been a long-running challenge of the company to figure out how do we get the right technology leader in place. And in the early days, if I can call it that, you know, 2007 to 2011, the tech scene in New York was rather nascent. And so we were doing this search where we're looking for a CTO, and I'd maybe met like 40 or 50 people in New York but hadn't found the right person. So at some point, I called up our recruiter and I said, hey, can we just explore candidates on the West Coast? And she said, sure. So I flew out to the West Coast for a day. And I met all these incredible people, including someone from Netflix, who talked exactly the right way about personalization and how that had transformed the media space and how personalization might transform the apparel space. And he was really excited to become our CTO with one caveat, which is he didn't want to move to New York City. So I was somewhat seduced by this idea of finally getting a really talented person and made what I would describe as one of the key errors that I've made in the last 8 years, which is we opened an office on the West Coast mm-hmm. to build our technology function on the West Coast. The travel, the cost, and most importantly, the tribalism between the two groups and the challenges that result when you have human beings who don't have to have face-to-face contact ended up making making this all add up to something that wasn't really working out.
And thank goodness New York caught up.
And well, thank goodness. You know, we were able to come back to New York, yeah. move a couple of key players over, the people who wanted to come, and now we've rebuilt the team 100% in New York.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Andy Dunn, co-founder of the men's online apparel company Bonobos. Bonobos are also a group of promiscuous apes who live in the rainforest in the Congo in Africa. When you came up with the name Bonobos, I assume it was like tongue-in-cheek a little bit, right? Oh, here's this promiscuous ape, and isn't that funny? And
yeah, it was the make love, not war ape. It mm-hmm. seemed kind of fun.
They're not monogamous, are they?
They're polyamorous.
Right.
And polyamory, we actually think, might even be the natural state for human beings, which is why we struggle so much with marriage. So the bonobo started as a nod to the fraternity-like origins of the brand. But what it's become for me is a little bit more of a guidepost for the way that men might approach modernity. Focusing on the matriarchal element of the bonobo's nature, to me, is a little bit more interesting in this era where we have, I think, an era of human history from 1900 to 2400 that I think one day will be called the rise of women. And you think women weren't able to vote in the U.S. 100 years ago, very limited exposure to post-secondary education even 50 years ago. And now we've got, the last 5 years, more female undergraduates than male undergraduates in the U.S. And now we've got this next challenge to tackle, which is the workplace. Combine that with gay behavior from bonobos, rendering obsolete any arguments that homosexuality might be unnatural, and observing that I got to New York in 2007 and there were only 7 states where gay marriage was legal, and now thankfully it's all 50. I do think there's something happening in terms of what it means to be a modern man, a modern heterosexual man. But I get excited now internally as we talk about the brand to talk about, you know, the evolution of mankind, starting with pants.
You have migrated both in terms of what you offer, not just pants anymore, but a whole collection to men and now women. But also, you are not just an online, you know, e-commerce company like Zappos, the shoe company, but you're more like a Warby Parker, which is like a blended model. You have these stores so that people can actually try before buying. Can you talk about that evolution?
So it was, again, one of those moments where it was a contrarian idea at the time that retrospectively makes us look smarter than we are. But we were struggling with our first product extension. We were trying to figure out if we could now make a better-fitting shirt. And having made a better-fitting pant, we saw a comparable problem in shirts, men's shirts, which is this syndrome that we call billowing muffin top, where you have too much fabric kind of billowing up at the waist. And it comes from the fact
not... You guys like all these little phrases, don't you?
Well...
The billowing muffin top and the khaki diaper butt, and you think long and hard about these.
It's a way to kind of frame the visual.
And I get it.
So we actually developed a pretty great fitting shirt. The only problem was that they didn't sell it all. You know, no one cared. We'd built so many hooks into Bonobos as a pants brand through PR, through word of mouth, through search engine optimization. All of the hooks into the brand were around pants. And so there was a rather reasonable concern that Bonobos should never sell shirts. So we had a board meeting where I said, I think we need to develop an in-person capability to educate our customer on these shirts. And there was a lot of pushback, as you might imagine. We ran an experiment to see if we could build a direct sales force. We put 2 fitting rooms in our lobby. And at that time, you know, probably we had a $20 million business. We started doing $1 million revenue run rate out of our lobby within about 60 days.
Just by having people sample the clothes.
Just by having people try on the clothes, walk out with a place e-commerce order. And that's when it dawned on us. Okay, number one, people still want to touch and feel clothing. That's obvious. But number two, we can actually potentially reconceive of a retail store without physical inventory.
Were there other examples of retail stores that didn't carry inventory that you looked to?
No. This was the first example of any digitally native brand building an offline concept in 2011.
Where do you keep your inventory?
So this is the revelation of the guide shop, is that we keep our inventory at our distribution center in Massachusetts. And What that enables us to do in the guide shops is offer the full range of fit and size, and then color and print, and have all of that basically be in stock, quote unquote, because it's in stock at the DC. And then consumers can get it within, you know, a day or two. And you have this thing that you turn on its head, which is this conventional wisdom that people want to walk out with the product, that human beings are somehow lemmings that need to immediately receive the clothing that they bought. And I think that's true in the case of food. In the case of clothing, it's not necessarily obvious that it's a great experience to walk out and carry it home yourself when we have an increasingly urban consumer who is off to dinner, back to work, to the gym, onto other things, and actually can come to view it as more convenient to receive it as a follow-up.
I want to go back to your co-founder, Brian Spaley. Now, you were good friends during business school, and you called him and pulled him away from his job to join you in New York. How come he only stayed for 2 years?
So it's interesting because originally he was the one that brought me in, and then I recruited him back. And then we got to a place where our observation was that the company really needed one leader. And I marvel at some of the companies that I'm aware of out there that are kind of figuring out how to do it with two leaders. I think it can be done. It can be with a co-CEO arrangement, which I think is unusual, but increasingly it seems to be working for folks. It can also be where one person kind of takes a backseat role.
But that wasn't this.
That wasn't us. You know, neither of us were skilled at backseat roles. And so we go back to Stanford Business School and talk a little bit about this experience, and we wonder why more people aren't more open about the challenges that come in professional partnerships.
Are you friends again, would you say?
I'd say we're friendly again. You know, we can spend time together, we correspond, we invest together. I would say the relationship that preceded it, it's not the same as it was then.
You still pay deference where it's due. I mean, he was the one who originated the idea and going to these tailors in San Francisco. And, you know, I'm sure there's a mutual respect despite the separation that occurred.
Tremendous respect. There's actually not a week that goes by where it doesn't occur to me that I wouldn't have earned the right to be an entrepreneur if he hadn't actually developed our hero product.
Your parents are immigrants. Your father is Irish and Swedish?
He's Irish and Swedish, multi-generation. So he was born in Chicago, grew up in the Midwest. My mom is the one who was born in a refugee camp in India at the time of partition and who grew up in New Delhi.
Now, how did they meet?
They were introduced by my dad's sister. My mom got shipped overseas at the age of 20 or 21, right after graduating from college, to make money to send home.
What did she do?
She became an X-ray tech at a hospital in Canada. And ultimately moved from Canada to Chicago, where she was working as an X-ray tech at a hospital called Loretto Hospital on the near west side of Chicago. And at that hospital was an American red-haired nurse named Jane. Jane Dunn, my aunt, who brought my mom home for dinner. And my dad at the time was a PhD student at Northwestern studying education and had this beautiful Indian woman who kind of just showed up and ended up asking her out. And I think a year later, my mom claims begrudgingly, they got married.
You talk about the love story between your European father and your Indian mother. There's also a love story that you unearthed, that your father uncovered between his mother and father, or your grandparents during World War II. Can you tell us more about that?
This moves back a generation. So on my dad's side, there was a trunk that was left in the basement of our house for many years, and his mother had told him not to open it until after she was gone. And my dad opened up his trunk, and it contained 1,000 letters that they had exchanged on the European front during World War II. She was a nurse, like her daughter would go on to be at Loretto Hospital, but a nurse who arrived at Normandy at day 8 and who followed the front lines all the way to the liberation of the concentration camps, dealing with patients right off of the front lines. So a horrendously injured men coming off the front lines and had a post-traumatic stress disorder that proceeded from that, as you might imagine. Meanwhile, my grandfather was an aviation hero of sorts. He earned the Distinguished Flying Cross as a navigator on a B-17
At one point, his plane was the only plane that survived a bombing by the Germans in Poltava, Russia, and they asked him to fly the plane back with a crew by itself, which, as you might imagine, is a bit of a sitting duck. So they elected not to fly over continental Europe. They flew and circumnavigated the northern part of Africa. And so you have my grandfather writing these letters from Casablanca and Tripoli, Alexandria, places exotic, you know, even to me at this point. In their love letters to this nurse who we met while he was injured. So they exchanged about 1,000 of those letters, which my dad discovered only after, you know, they were both gone. So he says he feels a little bit like Marty McFly from Back to the Future, a voyeur to his parents' romance, and he's now written a 400 or 500-page book about it.
Here you are in New York, living in the West Village, and you run this clothing company, and you're reading all these love letters and having this historical perspective of World War II. How does it situate you somehow?
Well, it's struck me as a bit funny because we've moved into this modern romance dating era, which I think Aziz Ansari has really appropriately captured with his book. And, you know, you have these like text messages and, you know, the degradation in human communication from my grandfather and grandmother's love letters, these eloquently worded, you know, heartfully rendered conversation that they're having and not able to see each other for weeks. And now it's, you know, midnight and you're at a bar and it's like, hey, question mark, right? And it's like, well, how far we've ascended technologically and how far potentially we've fallen, you know, from a romance standpoint. So I guess, like many people living in New York who are on the single side, it's been a journey for me. And I feel fortunate that perhaps I have something unfolding that's a little bit more romantic, which is I met a woman in the lobby of the Ace Hotel and for some reason was compelled to walk over to her and compliment her on her shoes. She was wearing these like Tinkerbell looking ballet flats. They actually were really cool shoes. People joke with me now that I probably don't even look at her shoes. But we started a conversation and she was very warm, which is, I think, it's not necessarily unusual, but in that situation, you have a lot of anxiety. Mm-hmm. And she just was very warm and had such a welcoming kind of spirit. We had a good conversation.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
My guest is Andy Dunn, co-founder of Bonobos. Coming up, we'll meet Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Emily Weiss, founder of the online beauty products company Glossier. Emily launched Glossier's first line of skin products in 2014. In 2010, she founded Into the Gloss, an online community dedicated to beauty. Visitors get tips on skin, hair, makeup, and learn the beauty routines of leading members of the cosmetic and fashion industries. Prior to starting Glossier and Into the Gloss, Emily was a fashion assistant at Vogue and W Magazines. Welcome.
Thank you. You know everything about me.
Is that all there is?
That's it. That's it. We can stop.
Well, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
How would you describe what Into the Gloss is?
The reason for being for Into the Gloss is really that as a, in the time I was a 25-year-old, style-minded, you know, very enthusiastic consumer of beauty and fashion. And I'd always loved beauty products, but I really didn't know where to look except going to a store to talk to someone who I'd never met before to give me advice. I thought that seemed kind of silly. So what I wanted to do was interview all my heroes. You said this interview will be an hour, and I was like, oh, no problem. I do this all the time. I sit on floors of women's bathrooms from Arianna Huffington to Alexa Chung to, you know, Selena Gomez and Isabel Marant and ask them about their approach to beauty. Mm. And that's not a simple question. The idea was really to bring beauty to the internet in a meaningful way.
Where does the conversation go beyond what is my beauty regimen?
Oh, all over. If you think about it, your relationship to beauty begins at a very young age, from watching your mother and what she does, from not being allowed to use certain things and then, you know, having to go out on your own, you know, from learning how to shave your legs to cutting yourself open to, you know, crazy eyebrow trauma suffered in teen years, tadpole brows. So it's not just the kind of Us Weekly, what's in your bag. It's not just what you're currently doing. It's everything that's gotten you there.
One's relationship with beauty, it's such a personal and complex relationship, yet there were so few places that you could go to where people were talking about just that mm-hmm. in 2010. And it's striking how, you know, fashion is much more public, right? Mm-hmm. Fashion has been pervasive. It's in every magazine. And it's sort of like beauty's coat.
Yeah, I think I like to say that's a really insightful comment because even from the beginning of Into the Gloss, I was kind of mad. I started to understand that beauty is almost like this kid's sister, this ugly stepsister to fashion. Like the clothes come first, it's all about the outfit, it's all about the shoes, and then you figure out your face and your hair kind of after.
Ironically, because that's probably, you know, what's most personal and important to every person.
Right, ironically, it's like really this... I mean, who isn't tormented by their hair, right? You're always figuring out what to do with it. So I think it is, I often in my life found that I started with beauty. Even just, you know, anecdotally, like changing my hair from brown to platinum blonde a couple of years ago, I was like a whole different person. People mm-hmm. didn't recognize me. And then I started dressing in an entirely different way.
We started this interview with a sound check where I asked, you know, what did you eat this morning? And you said, you know, you're on a cleanse and mm-hmm. you're eating these shakes with almond butter and what else?
So many things. Flaxseed oil, coconut oil, almond milk.
The reason I mention it is, you know, it's sort of like the gas in your gas tank that helps to bring the beauty to
totally.
The surface. It's all about the self in a way.
Yes.
And I think of Maslow's like hierarchy of needs. We have warmth and food and, you know, so next comes like self-actualization.
Thank you.
As part of all that, right?
I can't believe you're saying this because this is actually what I've been kind of banging on about is in the beauty industry, it's been founded on, I mean, you're talking about a $250 billion global industry. It's a storied industry with heritage brands like Estee Lauder and Helena Rubinstein and Elizabeth Arden who have, you know, were built 50 years ago and 60 years ago when technology was totally different, when communications and media were completely different, mm-hmm. and when women were completely different. And I think, you know, when those women created these really pioneering companies, they were addressing the needs of women at that time. And I think a big message that happened was very much about glamour, very much about fantasy, very much about a homogenous sort of image of perfect and white picket fence and husband and lady of leisure and, you know, blonde kids running around with a Labrador and Palm Beach and, you know, this sort of high life. And I think right now, I mean, it just couldn't be more different for the most part in terms of what women aspire to. Mm. And I think what women aspire to now is self-actualization, and that has replaced this sex sells fantasy. Mm. So it's not sex sells. I actually think it's self sells. I mean, most of my friends, at least, I can't speak for all women. When I think about what I aspire to, it's to be the best version of yourself, but you don't aspire to clone, you know, Eva Longoria on the red carpet. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's not the ticket to a better, to a happier me.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier, a digital direct-to-consumer beauty products company. She's also the founder of Into the Gloss, a website focused on beauty that she launched in 2010. Going back to the early days, when you were starting your blog, mm-hmm. You were working full-time at Vogue for Elisa Santisi, the mm-hmm. style director. You would work on your blog when?
Yeah, that's, I thank God I did that when I was like 25 because I would not be able to do that now because it took a lot of stamina. But I would transcribe interviews from, you know, 4 a.m. till 8 and then put up and write and edit whatever photos or, you know, interviews and then go to work by 9:30. And then I would typically shoot the features, you know, upcoming features on the weekends.
And Sally Singer, the Vogue editor.
Vogue.com.
Vogue.com. Mm-hmm. She was your first top shelf
yep.
feature. Top shelf is on your site. You interview people about their beauty regimen. Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
That was just amazing because I admired Sally. I mean, really, it was an opportunity at 25 to be in a room and actually have FaceTime with these women who I just so admired. And,
and not just any room. You're in
their
bathroom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So, and you're kind of disarmed. You're seeing something unsavory, no matter what. There's always like something weird. There's like a weird toothbrush that's frayed, and you're like, damn, I wish I would have thrown that out. You know, like you're in it together.
Have you ever done a top shelf interview where you've been surprised by what people's beauty routine is? I don't know. What are some unlikely finds?
I'm always interested in people's aversion or inclusion of plastic surgery. So I'm always really, you know, I always kind of ask. Sometimes I really ask if we're having a certain rapport, you know, I'm like, hey, do you ever get anything done? Do you ever get, like, especially women of a certain age, you know, like, you're like, so how do you look so good? You know, tell me. And so I'm always, it's always interesting to me who kind of fesses up and who doesn't. And I have no judgment either way. Some people just are very casual and are like, yeah, I get Botox. I go to this doctor. I go every 6 months. It's great. And other women are like, oh, no, I would never. But you know what? That's personal information. So it's whatever you want.
I want to talk about your background. You grew up in Wilton, Connecticut, although you lived in the South also because your father worked for Pitney Bowes.
Yes.
Now, Pitney Bowes, they put the stamping meter on mail,
postage
right?
meter.
Postage
yeah.
meter.
Yep.
So can you tell me more about your dad's job and your view of his job?
Sure. So the first thing I can tell you about my dad's job is never think that that's a fun game to play, just running pieces of paper through the postage meter to make cool designs, because actually you're printing money.
Because you had a Pitney Bowes machine in your house?
We did, yes. We had a Pitney Bowes machine in the basement, a postage meter.
And your mom is a homemaker.
Yes. And my dad's job, I mean, what I've learned from my dad and how I viewed my dad is he is the American dream. I mean, he is from a, you know, middle-class family in Ohio, didn't graduate college. He started working as a door-to-door salesman of Pitney Bowes products in his early 20s. He used to hand stamp his business cards. Funnily enough, he made my own first Into the Gloss cards with me. We did these little nail polish drops on every card. So each card was different, had a different color. And he ended up rising through the ranks to become president of Pitney Bowes. I learned a ton about, you know, perseverance and patience and hard work. There's probably not really many people out there who could say that I'm not extremely hardworking. Even with Into the Gloss, I spent, I think, $750 of my own money to, invest, quote unquote, in the building of Into the Gloss as a blog, and bought a camera for $500, and, you know, that was it.
What about your mom? Every woman in her moments has some communication with
her daughter.
Yeah, with her daughter, or even unspoken. Like, what did
yeah,
that look like?
I mean, I was very self-motivated by style and beauty. People often say, oh, you know, where did it come from? And it really didn't come from family. I think it came from media and from magazines like Vogue and from movies like Clueless and being in the mall. And I just loved it. And my mom just supported it and was really like, you know, you look crazy, but if you really want to go to school like that with like over the knee stockings, then like you can, but you're 12. So know that that's unusual. And I would say, I know, I'm going to go anyway and get made fun of.
And then what about her? Like, what are images? You know, I think of my mom. She had those curlers. You know,
oh,
I love
yeah.
putting curlers
She's
in my
pretty,
hair.
My mom's pretty, like, wash and go. Her hair, we have the same hair. It's straight, sticks straight. It's brown.
Were you judgy? Did you judge her when you
no.
were going through your...
Yeah. No, I don't think so. I mean, no. I would just be like, let's go shopping for me.
You wrote letters to Vogue when you were like 10 years old?
I don't know how old I was, but one was published and it was a reaction to a Arthur Elgort short skirt story. Arthur Elgort's this like fabulous photographer. And I remember writing this letter, editor's letter to Vogue and saying, you know, I really appreciate as a young woman your portrayal of miniskirts as like something that can be very classy and done tastefully and like done well and like bravo. And they published it. I mean, it's not like that big of a deal, but imagine you're like flipping through your new issue as like a 14-year-old and
yep.
you see your name and it says Emily Weiss, Wilton, Connecticut. I'm like, I'm famous. This is awesome.
Now, what were some defining moments in your path towards what you're doing now that, you know, you look back on in retrospect?
I would say the biggest, you know, moment for me and Mark, especially in my professional career, was my work with Elisa Santisi when I was, 23 to 25. I mean, I was a really precocious, I was a pain in the ass, like for sure, because I'm super ambitious. I'm really precocious. I have no filter. I say what's on my mind. I'm probably like the worst assistant, but she was so patient with me and we had so much fun. I learned so much from her that I would say it was really the first time in my life I had really worked so closely with another individual. Mm. Like, I'm usually a real loner, and it was really the first time I thought, oh, you know what? I really like teamwork. and I think that was a big moment.
Now, did you know when you were launching this blog that, yes, I want to convert this into something much larger, or did that kind of happen accidentally?
No, I knew it would be successful, but I didn't know what success meant, if that makes sense. So I was an art major at NYU. I never took a business course. And then I figured it out because it was like, oh, I get it. You have, if you are a media company, you make money through advertising. So let's get some advertising, you know.
And then that's where Carrie Diamond comes
in. Exactly.
So who's Carrie Diamond and how was she helpful?
So I told two people about Into the Gloss. Of course, I told my boss and I said, I'm starting this blog. And is that okay? And she said, sure. And the other person who I went to was Eva Chen. She heads up fashion at Instagram. But at the time, she was the beauty director of Teen Vogue. And I had never actually worked with Eva. But I asked, hey, can I come talk to you about this crazy idea I have? She said, this is great. You absolutely need to do this. And you need to go meet Carrie Diamond. Carrie is this visionary at Lancôme, the beauty company. I hounded Carrie Diamond. I wrote her all these emails. She's like, who is this person? And finally, I called her one day and she answered. And I was like, I gotcha. Like, hey, it's me. And she's like, what? And I'm like, hey, can I just come? I'll come anytime. She was like, can you be here in 20 minutes? I said, no problem. So I went to her office at Lancôme and I showed her my little sketch of how the website would look because it wasn't up yet. And she said, this is great. Have you talked to any other brands? And I said, no, I don't even know what I'm talking about. What are we talking about? And she said, good. I'm going to give you, I think it was like $2,000 or $5,000 or something. She was like, I'm going to give you $5,000 and I want an exclusive for 6 months on like all your banner ads. And I was like, great. I don't know what a banner ad is, but like, we'll build it. Mm-hmm. And thank you. It was great. It was like, hey, I have the, you know, ears of at least one person at this very, very big company who believes that we're onto something.
I want to talk about raising capital for a moment. Investors include Kirsten Green's Forerunner Ventures, mm-hmm. the entrepreneur Andy Dunn, who founded Bonobos, Josh Kushner's fund Thrive mm-hmm. Capital, the venture capital fund founded by the founder of The Gap, Bill Fisher. Talk to me about that process. And what is it that you told them you wanted to build?
The most influential beauty company of our generation. Kirsten Green, you know, is really someone to note here because venture capital is a highly male-dominated industry, as is the tech industry, as is the startup industry. And Kirsten's fund, it's noteworthy, is all females. She has, I think it's like four women who work with her.
So despite the dearth or the scarcity of women, both at venture firms, but also, you know, starting companies, like what pushback did you face?
I think in life in general, we as humans go off a lot of familiarity and a lot of pattern recognition. And when you're thinking about a room full of men meeting someone like me, coming in and talking to them about something they know nothing about, it's a much harder sell. Mm-hmm. You need to then support it with a ton of data. You need to support it with a ton of numbers. It needs to be really understandable why your mascara is better than the mascara down the street, you know? Mm-hmm. And that's something that I don't expect a table full of men to know as well as if I had come in and started talking about, you know, Dropbox.
Did you explain?
Yeah, I explained. I tried to understand what would help them understand the beauty market. And walking through the drugstore and trying to pick out a lipstick out of a wall of 700 lipstick colors that you can't even test because they're wrapped in plastic is also hard. And going to Sephora and talking to someone who you've never met before who has no idea, you know, who you are is also not ideal. So being able to talk about, you know, the direct-to-consumer relationship that we want to build through our background as being really expert storytellers and expert communicate, you know, really being able to communicate on the channels that women are on, like Instagram, like Snapchat, like, you know, our website and through the comment section, and building a company where we really want to engage her, you mm-hmm. know, and actually really want her to help build it with us and tell us what she's into and us be able to respond to her rather than this kind of archaic way that a lot of brands just have in their DNA where they say, we know best. We're going to make something over here in a place that you can't see and you don't know us, and we're going to throw it over the fence and then we hope you like it, you know, but we're not really going to talk about it with you is all a little bit like funky. That's a lot of the conversation we had.
building a cosmetics business is very different from building a blog. And so, you know, talk to me about, like, the chemistry of these products. Because, I'm kind of a skeptic. Like, I look at all this and I'm, first of all, overwhelmed. And I'm like, you know what? They all work the same. They all have water and, you know, X, Y, and Z, you know, in the first three ingredients. Mm-hmm. So talk to me about just, like, the raw chemistry behind how you went about it.
Absolutely. It's a great question. And it's one that many women have. The first thing that we did was hire an expert in-house who's product development, you know, done it for 10 years, and surrounded ourselves with various advisors, and also hired and contracted a independent chemist to work on developing with us, translating all of our ideas and our crazy, you know, ideas and our wants and our needs, kind of like an architect would with a home, mm-hmm. and would say, okay, let me create this recipe for you.
And it's been called, it's a democratic skin line for the Instagram generation, because the prices are accessible.
Yes. They're $12 to $28.
One fun part of all of this is that it comes in a bubble wrap bag that kind of has a pink tint, mm-hmm. and that's kind of kid-like.
Yeah, because I think beauty should make you smile. Like, it shouldn't make you feel like, I can't afford this, or it shouldn't make you feel like, should I use this last drop of eye cream, because if I use this and I'm out, and maybe I'll just use this one on Sundays. It's like, no, you should be able to use this all the time, not sweat it. You can have everything that we make, our whole collection, for under, I think, $200 now. Right. You know, you're like a baller, mm-hmm. for having like everything.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
My guest has been Emily Weiss, founder of Glossier.
If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris, or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.